Economic Growth Committee. We got a lot of paper, so. First up this morning, we have one, two, three, four. We have at least six bills, members. And in almost all cases, we're going to take testimony, hear from the authors. There are testifiers in almost every case. And then lay these over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. So with that, first up is Senate File 800-800. Senator Harrington, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is John Harrington, and I am pleased to offer today Senate File 800, which is the St. Paul Youth Job Corps. The St. Paul Youth Job Corps is a very successful program run by the City of St. Paul and receives program funds from the Workforce Development Fund. It's a one-of-a-kind program in St. Paul. It provides first-time employment experience during the summer months with supervisors working with young people on job training and life skills. The program really is I think, really has a threefold benefit. It is an employment program. It gets at least 600 kids off the streets and working every summer. But it's more than simply a jobs program because it teaches these young people both the discipline of work, the benefit of work. It gives them some extra money. And it's also, quite frankly, a public safety piece for us. Having young people actively employed, having them have a goal, having them have a reason to get up every morning and go someplace to get some work done has actually been good for public safety in the City of St. Paul. The youth that are served by this program are what I would describe as kind of on the bubble. They're not so far below the poverty line that they're homeless, but they're kids of poor to meager means. Oftentimes, it's not. As such, they're in a gap. They are not the kids that typically would get money from for the most impoverished, but they're also kids who don't have the means to have work or other activities readily available for them from their parents. One of the benefits of this particular program is that we have set it up so that all the jobs are within a mile of the youth's homes, so we have minimized transportation, and in order to cut costs, the City of St. Paul absorbs all the administrative costs and all the other costs, and so it is a very cost-effective program. It has very little overhead and very little extra tails to it at all. In addition, it does allow us to access and other dollars from other sources also. The jobs we have them working at are pretty much a complete range. Some people would say, well, this is just those, you know, summer picking up trash jobs. But in fact, these are jobs that are going to help build the foundation of good work for these young people. They run from construction jobs to landscaping to agriculture to media. It's an entire range of different occupations that these young people are exposed to. They get some real job experience, and I think it really does benefit them in that regard. The other hook to this for me is a program that we ran in the St. Paul Police Department that couldn't have happened if it had not been for the Youth Job Corps program. It's called SAGA, Stop Armed Gang Assault Program. It was a program that we used to reduce gang violence in the City of St. Paul by over 50%. It quite literally saved lives. Our murder rate dropped significantly after SAGA went into place. And the premise of SAGA is that you give young people a job, you give them the discipline of work, you give them mentors, and you give them the push that an adult working with them has, and those young people will make a choice to not be in gangs and not be involved in violent crime. And so SAGA was an incredibly effective program that could not have happened if we did not have the Youth Job Corps program funds. With me today, I have two testifiers. I have Kathy Corum, who is from St. Paul Parks and Rec, and Brian Morris, who is a SAGA graduate, actually, and a Youth Corps Job Corps participant and currently works at McDonough. So we would start with Kathy Corum.
Ms. Corum, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be here. As Senator Harrington mentioned, the Youth Job Corps program in St. Paul is one of a kind. It's a summer employment program for young people ages 14 to 21, which makes it unique. Of the $553,000 we received from the state in 2010, we did put nearly 600 young people to work in jobs throughout the city. We've provided the committee with a handout, and you can certainly read through that at your leisure. But in our work, not only in St. Paul departments, but we work with over 30 community partners to place these young people in jobs that are meaningful for them. They removed invasive species. They built rain gardens. They helped with summer meals. They led summer programs. They built bridges. They removed graffiti. They shelved library books. They made video documentaries and a number of other jobs that that the community partners in our city departments helped us create. In addition, we have young people that are earning certificates at horticulture academies, Eco Ranger academies. We have now over 30 graduates of our EMS Academy, which is a cooperative partnership that we have with Ramsey County, our St. Paul Fire Department and Parks and Recreation, where young people are finishing a summer youth employment program as first responders or EMTs. As a matter of fact, our other testifier this morning couldn't get out of his job with Alina to come and be with us today. We had over 1,800 young people apply for jobs in 2010, and even with the state money, we could afford only to hire about 600 of them. So the need for jobs for young people is great. As Senator Harrington mentioned, we look at this in three prongs as well. As a youth development tool, this is a real out-of-school learning time opportunity for young people who want to be challenged. They want to learn new skills. They want leadership opportunities, and summer jobs help provide that. As a workforce development program, we teach people how to manage money. We help the young people with interview skills and resume writing skills. We help to prepare them for work in other places. I'm of the opinion that young people who don't speak English as a primary language are at a disadvantage. Young people who live in poverty are at a disadvantage. But young people who are not connected to organizations are perhaps at the greatest disadvantage. And in our work with libraries, police departments, schools, parks and recreation, we're one of the connections for young people to help them have that first job and create pathways for them to careers. As the senator mentioned, jobs is one of the most important things for our teens. For some of them, they're spending money in their pockets. A few others are saving for college. For some, they're helping actually support their families. We don't have very many kids that are homeless, but we do have a few young people who are right on the edge that work in our Youth Job Corps program. We don't have kids that are connected in other ways to find that first job, and that's what makes it important. We work with diversion programs. We work with St. Paul Youth Services. We work with the police department. We work with probation officers. We work with Ramsey County's Runaway Intervention Program. And we may be the only connection for some of these young people to that first job. So it is truly also a public safety program. I'd like to introduce...
Ms. Quorum,
sure.
Before you introduce, is it
Bryant?
Ryan?
Yes.
So you had 500 employed last summer.
586, yep.
586.
Mm-hmm.
And then... Are they all, regardless of what they're doing, are they all making the same amount? Are they paid hourly? How do you, I'm trying to figure out what these, what are they getting?
In order to employ as many young people as we can, Chair, thank you for your question. They work about 15 hours a week for a 10-week program. The exception is the young people that are in the EMS Academy. They are paid for the entire time that they're in school, learning to be EMTs and first responders, so their hours are a little bit longer. All the other young people are scattered throughout the city in these jobs at about 15 hours per week.
So 15 hours per week.
For the 10 weeks of a summer program.
10 weeks. 586 youth,
mm-hmm.
And how much are they making?
They're in the $725 to $750 per hour.
Per hour. Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you. And then if you want to make more of an introduction?
I would. Bryant Morris is one of our Recreation Services employees as a Youth Job Corps member. He is a young person with exceptional skills as a youth worker and has already, even in only a couple years, become a mentor for some of the younger men that we have in our Dayton's Bluff Youth in Transition program, and he's currently working at McDonough Recreation Center.
Mr. Morris, welcome to the committee. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. The Youth Job Corps program is very important to me. It kept me out of trouble, kept me out the streets, because I come from Chicago. I just recently moved up here, so my life was the streets until I got into the soccer program, which I graduated from. Kept me out of trouble. Since I got in the program, I haven't been in jail since. And I was going to jail a lot. I've been in jail a lot. But it kept me out of trouble, kept my head straight, kept me focused. And it's more than just a job, because it keep me active and out the streets. And that's what more kids need, because the street life is not where it's at. Man, I'm nervous.
Who are we?
Mr. Morris.
We're all nervous.
Mr. Morris, you're doing great. You're doing a lot better than most of us do here.
Thank you. But, yeah, I've been doing it for 3 years. I've been working for 3 years on and off. The program is very important. I would like to see more kids out the streets, more kids in the SAGA program, more kids in youth and transition program. I wish I am a mentor every Saturday for younger teenagers. I just would like to see more kids out the streets, less kids in jail. Cause it's a good thing when somebody care for you, when somebody look out for you. Like Steve came to me. That was the first person I met at Dave's Bluff. That's the rec center that I was going to when I first moved up here. Steve kept me out the street. He put me in the program. Kept my head on, kept me in school when I wasn't going to school, period. This program was there for me, pretty much.
And so, Mr. Morris, can I ask one question?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it'll be hard. And you mentioned the name of a friend named, was it Steve?
Uh-huh.
So is that how you found out about this program and how you could fit into it?
Yeah, Steve.
So that my general question, and maybe Kathy could take this as well, is how is this advertised? How do kids know about it? Who do you work through? How do people find out? If this is doing a good thing, how do people hear about the good thing?
If I see a kid or if I know someone that's like in the streets, I'll talk to them. I'll send them to Steve, and then they come to our program every Saturday, which we keep up. The program is it's every Saturday and we check in with your school, see how your grades is, see if you've been suspended, see if you've been dismissed, and when you do weekly reports, you tell how your Monday was at school, your Tuesday was at school, your Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and so on, and then we know if you're lying or not because one of the Mary works at Humble, she works with a couple at a school. And we check in. We know a couple of the teachers, and we check in with their teachers and their principals and stuff like that.
And I have Senator Kreif with a question or comment.
Mr. Chair, one quick follow-up to that. In addition to word of mouth, the St. Paul Police Department, St. Paul and Ramsey County Probation, St. Paul Parks and Rec, all our public housing, all our vehicles that also advertise this program. So St. Paul cops during the year, as they find young people that are out there kind of in loose ends, would certainly refer children there. The cops that work in public housing and the public housing resident advisors also do this, and then as does the rec leaders from the Parks and Rec also are another vehicle for making sure that youth in St. Paul know about the program.
Senator Kreif.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to commend Senator Harrington for bringing this program forward. I think whenever we can help our at-risk kids, especially, to try to stay out of trouble and get them on the right path, I think it's a commendable thing, and I commend you for that. Mr. Morris, just have a quick question for you. What do you have a specific job that you do, or do you do different jobs? Are you learning about showing up for work on time every day? Are you, learning how to dress? I mean, what types of things do you do in your job? I'm just curious.
I work with kids. I work with kids from kindergarten through sixth grade. Yeah, I'm still learning how to get to work on time, too, because it's far. I work with kids. They do a homework program. It's like an after-school program where we help them with their homework, help them with we do tutoring. And we run little programs, give them a little free time and stuff like that. That's the only job that I do currently.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Mr. Morris, we have some state senators who are still learning how to get to work on time. So you could probably teach all of us a few things. Senator Harrington, any last remarks? I know you have a bill up in another committee, and members, we will lay this over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
My only closing remarks, Mr. Chair, is that this is a cost benefit program as far as I can see. When I look at the young people whose lives it has touched, it has literally saved the state of Minnesota millions of dollars. When you think of the $50,000 per person if they're incarcerated at a state penitentiary, the hundreds of thousand dollars it would cost to have them in juvenile correctional facilities, versus the improvement in their lives and the fact that these young people now coming out of this program will be taxpayers, they will be civically engaged young people in our community. These are young people who see the benefit of education and therefore are in our schools closing that achievement gap. I see a number of very quantifiable benefits, and the cost is very, very small to get to those benefits. So I appreciate your inclusion in this into the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Senator. So without further objection, members, we'll lay over Senate File 800 for possible inclusion. Next up, we have Senate File 694. Mr. Morris, good luck.
Thank you.
Good luck. Senate File 694, Mr. Senator Tomasoni. Ted, you want to grab this?
Ready? Okay. Mr. Chairman, you always leave on my bills. What's the deal on this? That's okay. You don't have to comment.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 694 is a request for an appropriation of $1,375,000 per year from the Workforce Development Fund for the opportunities industrialization centers that we have in Minnesota. And these opportunities industrialization centers have been operating in Minnesota since 1967, and the OIC State Council was incorporated in 1983. It is a part of the Opportunities Industrialized Centers of America, a national network of employment and training programs bound together by a common commitment to serving the unemployed. The OIC philosophy is centered on developing the whole person to become a self-sufficient, productive worker. There are currently five OIC centers and the in Minnesota, and the geographical areas that served go from Aiken to Washington County. And I want to point out now, for all of you new senators, this is what it's all about being a new being a state senator, because St. Louis County is not served by these, but I'm still carrying this bill for these people because it's a good bill, just so you know. Okay, so anyway, what they do is the OICs provide comprehensive services and training, including but not limited to certified nursing assistants and community health workers, adult basic education, vocational training and PSEO center options, small business ownership and self-employment, customer service skills, computer skills, pre-apprenticeship for carpentry, plumbing, electrician, sheet metal welding, and heavy equipment and operating programs. In 2009 and 2010, the OICs received $1.375 million per year from the state, and overall, the OICs served 2,438 unemployed and underemployed persons in fiscal year 2010. About 1,530 completed their training, 545 went into jobs, 770 advanced their careers through continuing education or technical training, and the OICs made full-time placements into full-time jobs with an average starting wage of $19,708. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn this over to my witnesses, because they're the ones that are the hands-on people and actually know what's going on and can explain the program to you better than I can. So go ahead and say your name for the record, and then
you can. Thank you, Senator Tomasoni, as well as Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Linda White, and I am a native of St. Paul. I have served as board chair of the Minnesota Opportunities Industrialization Centers for 20-plus years. I don't want to divulge my age. I got involved in OIC as a young banker. I've enjoyed a career in banking for 30 years. And the one constant in my life, even though I've served on many boards of directors, some 20, 30 over my career, the constant has been OIC. I want to, on behalf of our students, employees, boards ask for your continued support of Senate File 694. I want to also acknowledge my colleagues behind me representing the five OICs in Minnesota. We are so happy today, and in a minute you will hear from one of the students from our newest OIC, and we are so pleased to have her with us as well. We are supported by 75 volunteers like myself on boards of directors representing corporations, education, churches, industry, proprietors. As Senator Tomasoni pointed out, some of the information you have in front of us, I would like to add, the reason I feel that we are successful is because we utilize a whole person concept. That means that in addition to skilled training, we also address the soft skill training areas that support the students while they are in class, as well as we provide continued support after they leave OIC. We serve women and men. We serve many cultures. We serve all ages. That has also been a constant in the number of years that we have been involved in employment and training in the state of Minnesota. Our social impact is very important to us. And as we have looked at the changing demographics, in addition to where the jobs are going to be in the future, we have made sure that we have kept up with what we offer in terms of skilled training. We have gone to, as an example, from construction training, looking more at weatherization at this point and training in that arena. Health cares. We continue to provide a stackable type of career ladder from nursing assistant to licensed practitioner to registered nurse, if that is what the student desire. I am so pleased today, again, to have two people who will testify. Mitzi Hobart is from American Indian OIC. I will turn the mic over to her first. And then, again, we are so pleased to have Carolina Pedroso, who is a student at Teocalli Teocoto OIC. Mitzi.
Thank you, Linda.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm grateful to be here. My name is Mitzi Hobart, and as Linda mentioned, I'm here to represent the OICs and specifically the American Indian OIC. The American Indian OIC is located in South Minneapolis, but we serve individuals from all over the Minneapolis and St. Paul area. We offer education, you know, GED training, as well as a high school on site. We have an accredited post-secondary vocational training institution, which is accredited by North Central Association, as well as many other colleges in the area. And we offer employment services. One of the things that makes us unique is that other than a large educational institution, we can create training programs that are short-term, skill-based programs that directly reflect some of the employment needs within the different industries. Over the last 15 years, we've spent a great deal of time developing programs related to healthcare in positions for, introductory positions that allow for someone to get access into the system and then get advanced training in order to move up the ladder. We've spent some time developing nursing assistant for a number of years, home health aide. We've advanced to offer trained medication aid, acute care, and emergency medical technician. We're in the process of submitting a proposal to the Board of Nursing for an LPN program that will be available this fall. And many of you may know that it is very difficult for individuals to get in nursing programs, and we have had our doors full of people wanting to come in to get access to those programs. With the current unemployment, we have seen our numbers grow dramatically over the last year. We've grown at least 100%. We've had to open up two new sites, one in Tabathany Community Center and another within one of our employment partners' facility itself, Golden Living. Each of these areas that we focused on are direct occupations, current currently high-ranked occupations in demand within the industry. Home health is currently ranked second occupations in demand. Nursing assistant is currently ranked sixth. LPN is currently ranked ninth. And each of these skill-based positions can directly impact those needs within the industry. One of the things that we have learned over the course of time is that we needed direct employment partners in order for this to be successful. And we have a myriad of employers on board who review our curriculum to provide oversight along with the Minnesota Department of Health. And our direct employers once that graduates finish. We have just developed a very unique employment program that connects graduates immediately with employers. And over the past 4 months, we've had 43 graduates get direct employment once they've walked out of class. In fact, now we're at the point where we have so many jobs available that we're waiting for people to graduate. So we have been very successful, I think, in keeping the employers involved and making sure that their needs are being met, that we're providing them with the most qualified candidates, that we have adequately prepared them for the responsibilities of being in healthcare, and we expect to continue doing that going forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, please state your name.
I haven't even said one word.
Okay. You'll be great.
Hello, Chairman and the members of the committee. My name is Carolina, and I'm just going to tell you a little bit about my background, how I got to meet OIC. The company that I was working for, Advanced Medical Institute, they went under. And with them, a bunch of people like me, I became the manager the last 3 months of them being open for business. So I was really, really excited. I bought a new car, a Lincoln Navigator. So I was like, yes, finally, my dream car. So I, after 3 months, they told me to not to bother going to work because the company was closing down. So being a single mom, I really, I just sat down and cried because I'm like, what am I going to do? I was like, I don't have a job. It's like, thank God I was able to get unemployment for a little while. But otherwise, I wouldn't not be able to feed my kids. So I was like really, really frustrated. I was like, what am I going to do? So I got unemployment and then I started. I knew I wanted to open my business, but I just didn't know how or, who to contact because I was really bad at computers. So I was, I was able to get in touch with OIC. And luckily, they were people that spoke Spanish. I speak a good English, but I'm more comfortable with, speaking Spanish. So they helped me a lot. They got me into training on how to use QuickBooks and how to, prepare my taxes and how to, pretty much they walked me through every single step to how to open the business. I didn't have a clue that they were so much into opening a business, but finally I opened the business. I've been in business for, a few years, and I'm just really, really excited. I also contact them because I needed to have some employees. My employees, they need to speak Spanish and English because I have a lot of both. I have a lot of mixed communities in my my work. I do laser hair removal. That's what I do. And we also do Botox, and we do, just making people pretty, and, that's my job. So it was really, it was really hard. They were able to help me, so I'm just really, really glad that, they were really there for me. And being a single mom, it was really hard, but I did it, and, now I have my employees. I love being the boss. and I just, I'm thinking about opening a second spa, and I'm thinking that it's going to be near the Minneapolis area because there's, there is a lot of businesses that, are going under, and I mean, it's really bad for them, but that's opening up a lot more spaces at a cheaper rate. So, taking classes of entrepreneurship and stuff like that, really, I knew I wanted to be a business owner. I just didn't know how to do it. I was like, it was behind my brain, but it, luckily they walked me through, every step. So,
Caroline, when you look down the table at Senator Tomasoni, do you...
Is there anything you can do here?
There's no hope. There's no hope.
It's best not to answer.
That's another one you don't have to answer.
No, I can, you know, I'm really excited that I'm, you know, also able to help a lot of people with, you know, acne. Like, I get a lot of people that have acne, and it's really, I mean, I don't know how they feel because I have never had acne, but I, you know, just looking at their face, I can tell that they're, you know, not only in pain, but it really puts their self-esteem really, really low. So they're always walking and they're, you know, trying to, you know, cover their faces and stuff. So I'm really happy that I, you know, I get to have my own business, pay for my own bills, raise my two kids and, you know, not get unemployment because that was not a lot of money. So, you know, it's really exciting that I'm able to pay my bills. And I'm also going to school to be an MA. So, and you never know, maybe I'll be a doctor in the future.
Well, thank you for your testimony and good luck. Senator Tomasoni, do you have some concluding remarks for us this morning?
I got these things on, Mr. Chairman. The success stories are obvious, and the program itself has been serving Minnesota for a long time. When the public assistance savings, the taxes, the wages, the benefits, and the incarceration avoidance are taken into account, there's a $16 return for every dollar of investment on this program. And so, as you can see, it's definitely worth our time and our money. So I want to thank you all for being here today. And
thank you.
Chairman,
you
I appreciate the committee's time.
Thank you all very much. And Senator Tomasoni, thank you for bringing this forward. Members, without objection, Senate File 694 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Members, we're going to take Senator Torres Reyes' bill next. I know she has some testifiers that might not be able to stay the duration of the hearing, so we want to accommodate that. So Senate File 761. Senate File 761, Senator Torres Reyes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. This is my first bill, Mr. Chairman.
Let's go.
For this session. So thank you so much for the opportunity to present. I really appreciate it. And members, I have to tell you that this is a very exciting thing for me to be in this committee. I used to serve in healthcare education before. And I was looking forward to be part of the Economic Development and Jobs Growth Committee. Because a lot of the work that I do and I've done in the past is really related to opening opportunities for low-income people. And this committee, for me, presents a great opportunity to bring to you perhaps some of the experiences that I have dealt with in the past in terms of advocating for low-income children, in particular in education. And I decided that this is going to be really my priority today, because we need to look at opening opportunities for economic self-sufficiency in low-income communities. And this bill is precisely about that. Senate File 761 is really an outcome of a conversation that I've had for a long time in trying to figure out who is out there helping low-income communities and low-income families, low-income individuals develop economic self-sufficiency and really understand how to access services and opportunities for training and access capital. And I happen to know the executive director of this program, and I knew about the work that he was doing but never had the opportunity to engage with them at a professional level. I just knew that this was happening. And the reason I knew is because they help a restaurant that I really love, and it's called La Loma Tamales. And La Loma Tamales is owned by a guy who really knew how to make tamales, and that's all he knew. And he's an immigrant, and he decided to do some very informal catering several years ago in Minnesota. And I ate the first tamale in Minnesota a few years ago, and it was just absolutely divine. And he wanted to open his business, but nobody in Minnesota knew what a tamale was. And so the Department of Health had to go through extensive work in order to license tamales in Minnesota. The same thing happened to tortillas, because people in Minnesota really didn't know these products. Well, the Neighborhood Development Center was behind all of this, trying to really open these opportunities, figure out how to market these products, how to train people like Enrique from La Loma Tamales and many others. And I invited them to tell you their story and to tell you about the work that they do today, because many of the groups that are working today in opening opportunities for small businesses actually were helped by the Neighborhood Development Association. And thankfully, for being in this committee, I learned that actually they don't get funding from the state. And I was troubled with that, because we have really reduced their ability to expand and really look at how they do businesses outside of the cities in particular. And I think that we have low-income communities in suburban communities, we have low-income communities in rural Minnesota, and we need to expand the services throughout the state of Minnesota. They need to be working in every corner of the state, opening opportunities to small businesses, just like they have in Minneapolis. And so I wanted to invite three individuals to help us really understand how this bill actually will work. And I decided, Mr. Chairman and members, that it will be important that they present to you really the faces behind this concept. One is the actual organization, how they do the work, and Mr. Mike Damali, who is the CEO of the organization, will explain to you how he does the work. But I asked him to really invite a representative from the bank industry, because he works with banks in doing this work. And so they rely on really private capital to do a lot of this work. And then to ask an entrepreneur to come and tell us his story. And part of the struggle that Mr. Tamali faces right now is that he can work with bank industries, of course, to open access to capital, but it is the training piece and all of these pieces that I mentioned, for instance, in trying to sell a product that people actually don't even know about. And so how do they prepare these people to train them to sell their product, to market their product, to look for locations and places in the state where they can sell their product? So, Mr. Chairman and members, I would like to ask Mr. Tamali to start.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record, please.
Mike Tamali, and I'm not the owner of the tamale business she mentioned.
It could be confusing.
Although you'd think you're right. You'd think I should be, maybe.
Yeah.
So I'm the president and CEO of ND's Neighbor Development Center, but I actually would like to ask Tony Lemaire, who's the president of Western Bank and one of our longtime partner banks, to maybe go first here, if I may.
All right. Mr. Lemaire, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Michelle, and members of the committee. My name is Tony Lemaire. I'm president and CEO of Western Bank. It's headquartered near here in the urban community of Frogtown. And what I like about my job is helping people and businesses succeed. But a bank can't approve many of the requests it receives for credit because it has to be conservative in its risk-taking in order to protect its depositors, satisfy its regulators, and also make a reasonable profit. So as a result, there are many energetic and qualified new entrepreneurs that cannot find the capital they need to launch their businesses and within the banking community itself. So this is why Bill Sands, our major shareholder, started NDC, seeded NDC several years back. NDC is an independent 501(c) that works with many community banks in the area to continue their mission. So NDC plays a vital role in this credit chain for business owners. They can assume more credit risk than the banking model allows for. They provide training and advice that banks aren't equipped to give, and they provide continual technical assistance, which helps these companies succeed. Even the most dedicated community bank cannot and should not provide these needs. So as a result of these efforts, we've seen neighborhoods revitalized, jobs created, taxes paid, values increase, and these neighborhoods become safer places for their citizens and for their businesses. So these companies that NDC coaxes to succeed, they grow, they become more stable, they employ more people, and eventually they become bankable in organizations like ours and the other banks in the community. But I think without the initial funding and assistance that they receive from NDC, I believe a vast majority of these businesses would never have realized their potential. And so as a as a member of NDC's board, I'm on NDC's loan committee and obviously also on the bank's loan committee, and I can tell you from experience that there are many loans that we approve in NDC that go on to be very successful businesses and employ a lot of folks and pay taxes in their neighborhoods that the banks would never, ever be able to approve just because of the different risk profiles. So it's a great service to have that in the credit pie. Mike?
So thank you. So I'm Mike Tamale again, President and CEO of the Neighbor Development Center. So we've been doing this for about 18 years. Our real niche is kind of low-income entrepreneurial talent, trying to find people that in many cases are actually involved in the underground economy but are not, you know, above ground. They're not paying taxes. Maybe we try to find them, train them extensively to run a real business, elevate them above ground, get them paying taxes, get them located in their own communities and commercial spaces through the training we do, which is about writing a business plan, the financing that we do. We do about 40 to 50 loans a year, and in many cases using a deed program, a State of Minnesota Urban Initiatives program, as one of the pieces of our loan structure. And get folks into business that way. They're mostly startup. They're mostly located in their own inner city neighborhood. And then we keep working with them so that once they're in business, they're not all making mistakes that are going to kill their business. We have all sorts of expertise from lawyers to marketing folks to accountants, et cetera, so that they run their business properly, they pay their taxes, they pay their employees, and they grow. At this point, and we do this, by the way, in five different languages. We do this primarily with entrepreneurs of color in low-income neighborhoods. Right now, you have a two-page in front of you that shows that we have right now about 425 of these folks are currently operating in business. On average, they have three jobs plus the owner, so there's really four jobs per business. So there's about 1,700 employees plus the 425 owners right now that are working because of this program. Our cost per creating each job is $4,658. That's our programmatic cost as calculated by Wilder Research. The average wage is $10.75 an hour, so these are kind of working class jobs, but it's all getting folks, both the owner and the employees, on a ladder that moves up. Over time, the owners and the business move up to be bankable over time. The employees can move up from startup entry-level jobs into management jobs, and a lot of them end up starting their own business eventually. Overall, they put back over $30 million a year into our regional economy, these 425 businesses, and pay $4 million in taxes. Right now, the average length in business is 6 years, so these are not businesses that come and go, although some do. We have our share of businesses that either sell or close for one reason or another. But the average NDC alumni business has been in business over 6 years right now. So I think with that, I'll turn the mic over to Donald Bryant, who's one of the entrepreneurs we've been working with. He's the CEO of Alden Group Distribution in North Minneapolis.
Thank you,
Mr. Bryant. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Chair, members of the committee. I am the founder and president of the Alden Group. We're headquartered, as mentioned before, in North Minneapolis. The Neighborhood Development Center has played a significant role in our success. We actually manufacture, market, and distribute a line of celebrity-branded olive oils under the brand B. Smith Extra Virgin Olive Oils. For those of you who are interested, you can actually pick up the brand of olive oil in all of the Cub Foods. Actually, Super Value was our first customer. And so we're in the olive oil aisle. We now have distribution nationwide in over 2,000 stores in Southeast, the Northeast, the Mid-Atlantic, and the Midwest. And this year, we're going to add another 1,500 stores to that distribution number. NDC played a significant role in our success because they not only provided some capital and funding, which at the time we were not bankable, as was mentioned earlier, but they saw something in us and also provided some technical assistance through business advisory services. We operate in a very capital-intensive industry, in a very competitive industry, and some of the experience and the knowledge that they had internally has significantly supported us to be able to maneuver through some of the difficult things that we have to maneuver in this competitive space. I would also add that, they've given us some we launched another product in 2009 called Green Clean Organic Cotton Wipes, and we actually have about placement in about 1,500 stores. They're in every checkout lane in Cub Foods locally here, and they were in Lunds and Byerly's. Some of the knowledge that they bring in the sensitivity that they have for organizations of our size, they've really helped us to be able to maintain about four jobs in North Minneapolis. It kind of touched my heart as I was listening to the young man this morning as I saw him, because one of the reasons that we wanted to allow our headquarters to be in that region was because we wanted to kind of be an influence and to be in a position to be able to allow our organization to be able to influence other young men and women who live in those communities to be able to see imagery of individuals succeeding and give them the opportunity to potentially learn about sales, to learn about marketing, to learn about distribution, to learn about how to manage a supply chain that's international and also regional. So, our organization, if it was not for NDC, I don't believe we would have achieved the growth. And I would have to say from 2009 to 2010, we experienced about 78% growth. But around the time we started working with NDC, we actually grew from that time to now. We grew another 90%, and we're able to maintain some of the jobs that we had were at risk of losing. And so, in addition to that, it gave us access to other functional expertise that we wouldn't have been able to afford if we had not come in contact with NDC. So, I, on behalf of all of the other entrepreneurs, Enrique from La Loma Tamales and some of the others that have benefited, I would say that, the support of this organization has been priceless, and that's the reason that I selected to come and represent them today.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Bryant. Mr. Tamale, looks like you're ready to give us a little more.
Yeah, one second, pardon me, but I just want to mention another memo you have which shows that right now our businesses are paying over $700,000 in state sales tax annually, and $200,000 is our estimated Minnesota state payroll tax coming out of our employee base from these entrepreneurs. The thing I wanted to mention quickly was that 4 years ago we came before this committee, and Senator Tomasoni was chair at that point, and we were seeking some help for the Midtown Global Market, which is in the Sears building on Lake Street, which features about 40 of our entrepreneurs. We're about to celebrate our fifth anniversary this summer, and frankly, that's in great thanks to what this committee did 4 years ago, because they supported us, and we really appreciated that. That's probably why we're open today and doing great. Thank you.
Sure. Well, I think Senator Metzen deserves some thanks for that one.
That's what I'm saying. Didn't I say that, Senator Metzen?
And Thomas. You were thinking that, I know.
I was thinking there.
Chairman. Senator Metzen.
How does, thank you, Mr. Chairman, with the UI and the NDC and the banks, you get a three-legged stool here? Is that how it works?
On some deals, most of our deals cannot get any bank financing initially because they're just.
Mr. Chairman, even if they subordinate to the others, two?
Typically not the first loan. No. Typically there's, as startups, even if we're in a subordinated position and do a lot of training and hand-holding, most of these folks need a couple years of seasoning before then they're bankable.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I thought if they were, third in position or something, but they'd look at it and might do it, but usually not.
Right.
Senator Torres-Rae, any concluding remarks here? I appreciate you bringing in some all-star testimony here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I would very much appreciate your support. I have really looked into this opportunity of bringing these kind of cases and opportunities to the committee, and I'm going to continue to, and I hope that after session, because I know the time is limited, that we could go and visit some of the places like the Global Market, and you can visit with some of these entrepreneurs. I hope that you meet a person like Enrique from La Loma Tamales, because it's really a story that has been showcased nationally, a person that started with very little. And they can tell, you know, all of the people in the Global Market, Mercado Central in Minneapolis, can tell you these stories. And I hope that we can continue to support these ideas. I'm also working with MITA. MITA does a little bit of a higher level kind of training. But we recently had a conversation with all of them to see how is that we can support each other on this effort of growing and really expanding these partnerships with the private sector as well.
I appreciate that, Senator Torres Ray. And if this committee can make it to Hibbing, we can sure make it to South Minneapolis, right?
Yes.
Senator Tomasoni.
Like, Mr. Chairman, the Global Market is definitely worth a trip. We went there 4 years ago, and it's definitely worth a trip. But I wanted to ask Senator Torres Ray if that first tamale you ate was a hot tamale or not.
And, you know, it's interesting when we, really looking at how to learn about these stories about the businesses, Mr. Chairman and members, the story behind these businesses, there are so many. Is something that everybody connects with this organization. Even the Mike and I were talking about the testifier that came before in your bill, Senator Tomasoni, came through NDC and EDC for training. So there is a lot of connection between this organization and multiple organizations that are working right now in the state of Minnesota to expand opportunities for very small businesses in low-income communities. So with that, I ask for your support, Mr. Chairman and members, to introduce this in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, members. So, and thank you, Senator Torres Ray. So without objection, we will lay over Senate File 761. And next up, we're going to have Senate File 803.
I have heard.
All right.
Ted, can we do Senator Howe's bill? He's got three. So I'm Senator Howe, I'm going to... Yeah, you're jumping. You're doing the right thing, but you should thank Senator Lilly for giving you a little head start here. But we know you have some testifiers. So, members, this is Senate File 803, a small business loan guarantee program. Senator Howe. And then we'll take yours, Ted. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate File 803. Is a proposal that will address one of the most significant needs of small businesses that are attempting to regain their footing coming out of the recession. Lack of access to capital continues to be a barrier for growth for many small businesses. The financial collapse of 2008 resulted in the tightening of our credit markets. A loan guarantee that is proposed in this legislation would restore a valuable tool to the business financing in Minnesota. The Minnesota Community Capital Fund has successfully provided subordinate debt financing for small businesses for the past 8 years. The mechanism for recapitalization of this fund was to package and sell their loans to the secondary market. A loan guarantee proposed here would restore the ability to sell these loans on the secondary market and allow for the continued recapitalization of this source of business lending. I have with me representatives of the Minnesota Community Capital Fund who can explain a bit more about this proposal. Once the witnesses have testified, we will stand for questioning. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd ask that the president of the Minnesota Community Capital Fund, Scott Martin, speak.
Mr. Martin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Howe. I'm the president of the Minnesota Community Capital Fund, which is a private nonprofit corporation serving all of Minnesota as a gap lender. We are a membership corporation comprised primarily of local governments, both cities, counties, townships, and even some regional governments, nonprofit economic development organizations, as well as some electric utilities. So we have the private sector. It's truly a public-private sector partnership. And as Senator Howe noted, we've been around for 8 years as a lender. We provide financing to small businesses. That's who we are, that's what we do, and the uniqueness of our organization in terms of the collaboration of the public-private partnership is one thing. The other unique thing that we've done successfully over the years is originate our loans in partnership with banks, and I want to emphasize that. We always work with local banks to help businesses get the financing they need when they need it at market rates, at fair competitive market rates. Our capital source has been always the national capital markets, read Wall Street. Our loans have been originated for sale on what's called an advanced commitment basis to large institutional investors, large national banks like Bank of America, brokerage houses like Merrill Lynch, and even some of those that are no longer around anymore, like Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers prior to the financial crisis in 2008. And since 2008, unfortunately, we've not been able to meet the demands of small businesses in Minnesota who are looking for financing so they can create jobs, so they can expand their facilities, purchase equipment, or what have you. It's really all about access to capital for small businesses, and recently it's been about access to capital for the Minnesota Community Capital Fund from those frozen national markets. The proposed bill before you would establish a dedicated trust fund for a state small business loan guarantee program from which would put a 70% loan guarantee on the loans that are originated by us and others. This is not just a bill for the Minnesota Community Capital Fund. There are some other organizations that have in the past and may in the future sell loans to the secondary market. But it does have the specific feature of being designed to provide some government backstop, as it were, or some guarantee support at a 70% level so the loans are then once again marketable to that secondary market. The market is very much still risk adverse, but they have told us in many conversations we've had with institutional investors that with a 70% loan guarantee, once again, we'll be back in the game. We'll be able to make loans anywhere from $50,000 up to $1.5 million. Our average loan historically has been about $400,000, and that's as part of a total package with local banks. The program complements a lot of the things that you've heard about today and are going to be hearing about. Specifically, I had a conversation last evening with Bob Kill, the president of Enterprise Minnesota, who I know has a bill coming up yet today. Bob not able to be here, but we talked about their recent state of manufacturing survey that Enterprise Minnesota conducted and showing that it's still very much a critical need for access to capital for the small manufacturers throughout Minnesota that they found. And Bob does recognize, supports the bill as complementary to what Enterprise Minnesota does. We're a gap lender. A lot of the small manufacturers, or just the manufacturers that Enterprise Minnesota works with, are in need of gap financing because their banks are either unable or unwilling to meet all the needs of the borrower. We also gained the support of the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota as a good policy. Many of their partners or their banks have been partners of ours in the past. David Skillbred, legislative representative from ICBM, is here if there's any questions of ICBM. Bottom line is it's all about access to capital, and if businesses can get capital when they need it at a fair price, jobs will follow. We have been in the past and hopefully can in the future finance any kind of businesses in Minnesota that's looking for capital to add jobs. With that, I'd like to introduce two of our board members from the Minnesota Community Capital Fund. Greg Holen is a vice president of commercial lending for Bremer Bank in St. Cloud, and I'd like Greg to briefly talk about the experience from the banking side of the equation and how we add value to what they do.
Mr. Holen?
Yes, thanks.
Mr. Holen, do you do any business with this Senator Peterson?
I certainly know of him.
All right, we'd ask you to refrain from testifying to that on that
All
today.
Right.
Mr. Holen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I've been on the board of Minnesota Community Capital Fund since its inception, and what excites me about that is the role of kind of the gap lending, which you just heard a lot about, so I won't comment more about that other than to say that I think as we're emerging out of a pretty tough couple years economic-wise, a lot of borrowers are stressed, and having additional gap funding is really critical to making sure there's enough capital out there to meet the needs as these companies are starting to, you know, want to access capital again. So I won't speak more about that because it was done really well previously. But the unique part about what Minnesota Community Capital Fund did is we sold our loans into that active secondary market. In 2008, as the capital market shut down, the program really didn't have a way to keep its fund going. So this guarantee program allows us to do that. And again, as an SBA lender, which is primarily what I do at the bank, we still get guarantees on our loans, and we are able to sell those. That market is very, very active right now because of the government guarantee part of it. So we do think that this fund can really get going and operating again the way it should by adding the guarantee in the place for when we try to sell the loans. That's kind of what I think, Scott.
Senator,
thank you.
Senator Howe, I have a question from Senator Kielash.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Howell, where did the 70% come from? It seems awful high. The banks don't have a lot of risk in it with that guarantee. Maybe I'm missing something, but.
Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kielash, I'll let Mr. Martin speak to that.
Okay.
That number comes from conversations with the market. The market is still very skittish, still very risk adverse. When I talk about the market, I'm talking about the national capital market, institutional investors, not only banks and brokerage houses, but pension funds have purchased our loans in the past. And they're saying for them to get back into the business of buying our loans, which, by the way, if I didn't mention this, they're subordinated loans. They're in a second position to the bank, so they carry higher risk as a result. But prior to the financial crisis of 2008, we were able to sell those subordinated loans without any kind of guarantee. There's an active market, and Greg's familiar with that if you want to pursue that. There's currently an active government guaranteed market, a sale market, with a 90% guarantee from the federal government. The SBA loans carry a 90% guarantee, and so there's an active, vibrant market for those kinds of loans. We try to get commitments from institutional investors. What's the base amount? We started at 50%, quite honestly, and they said, I don't think that's enough. Not in a subordinated position. And for us to be effective in working with the banking partners, we need to be in a subordinated position in almost all of our loans. In some rare occasions, we've shared a first, but typically we're in a second position, higher risk on the collateral, and subsequently the market is the one that's sending us that 70% signal.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kielash.
With these kinds of guarantees, though, one of my concerns is that some of the questionable loans that went out in the last few years that helped contribute to the crisis, there is no, I don't see the oversight that is needed to make sure the state's not on the foot in the bill for poor choices by banks to lend the second loan. So that's one of my concerns about it as well. So,
well, a couple of responses to that. First of all, that the bad commercial lending that's gone on has primarily been for non-owner occupied speculative real estate development. A lot of the bad loans that are in bank portfolios were for real estate development out in the hinterlands, land deals. We've never done that. We only do, and that would be part of the underwriting requirements that would be negotiated with the commissioner of deed under the provisions of the bill. We only do owner-occupied, owner-operated businesses. So that's a lot different. The defaults in that area have been few and far between in our portfolio and in most of the bank's portfolios. The bad stuff has been from the speculative real estate or development market. Our loan loss history is less than 1%. So at least speaking for the Minnesota Community Capital Fund, I'm confident that the backstop that we're asking for from the state of Minnesota in this program is not one that's going to be drained. I'm looking at a fund that's going to be self-sustaining and continually operating and not have to be replenished every year because we make bad decisions. That said, the bill does provide for the commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development to not only prescribe the loan terms and conditions but to sign off on every loan guarantee. I should mention also that Commissioner Phillips, we have talked on numerous occasions to Commissioner Phillips about this. He certainly acknowledges the need for access to capital in Minnesota for small businesses and is also supportive of what we're trying to do and has asked me to tell you that the deed, if the body decides to approve this legislation, deed is prepared to implement it as per the provisions in the bill. It is not in the governor's budget. We understand that appropriations are very difficult in this day and age, but really what we are hoping will come out of the session is the establishment of the fund with a modest appropriation to maybe it's even a pilot project or something, so that perhaps other funds from other sources, non-state sources, might go into that fund in the future to build up the security behind it.
Just lastly, Mr. Chair.
I guess we have two other bills I want to get to before
okay.
session.
And that is, because this is a loan guarantee fund, does this money ever really leave the state's coffers unless something goes wrong?
Only if it's a default, yeah. Only
so
in the
this is
default.
Always, this just sets aside the money to guarantee it. And,
right.
Okay, thank you.
And it also provides, just briefly, it provides for every time a loan guarantee is applied for on a specific loan, the applicant, in this case Minnesota Community Capital Fund, would pay 25 basis points to help cover some of the costs of administration, maybe ultimately, depending on the volume, build up the reserves in that fund.
Thank you.
Well, Senator Howe, did you want to have, is it Baldwin?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I have with me a representative from the City of Brooklyn Park, Amy Baldwin, and she just has a short testimony here.
Ms. Baldwin.
Thank you, Senator Howe. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amy Baldwin. I'm the business developer with the City of Brooklyn Park, and just wanted to make a few short comments that the passage of this bill is important to local economic development agencies, as it will make the Minnesota Community Capital Fund once again a viable resource for us to have in assisting businesses with their growth and financing needs within our communities. The fund has assisted two significant projects within Brooklyn Park in the past, prior to the economic downturn and changes to the capital market, providing a combined $1.3 million of financing to the companies. And based on the model of the fund, the city had a no-risk investment in the fund and only provided $78,000 into the fund itself, leveraging in a significant amount the resources of the city, again, to provide $1.3 million of financing within our community. So we believe that the proposed guarantee would allow our Brooklyn Park businesses and those throughout the state of Minnesota to, again, be able to take advantage of this funding source within the state. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Senator Howe, concluding remarks?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I hope that you would support this, and I would move Senate File 803 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right, Senator Howe's moved to lay over Senate File 803 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Thank you, Senator Howe, Mr. Martin, and others. Let's take Senate File 783 now. This is Senator Lilly. And then, Senator Metzen, you are warming
on
up
deck.
On deck.
On deck.
Thank you.
And I have Mr. Girard's name down here, so please join us, Mr. Girard. Senator Lilly, Senate File 783.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I have about 30 pages of testimony, but I had Senator Metzen cut those back for me before I got started. I'm here to ask you to please support Senate File 783, which is a Enterprise Minnesota program that was referenced in the last bill's presentation regarding the Growth Acceleration Program, otherwise known as GAP. GAP seeks to provide a direct state investment of $1 million in the next biennium to assist small and medium-sized businesses, manufacturing companies, that can benefit from this matching investment to help them stay in business, compete, and retain and add new jobs and grow their businesses. These are for small and medium-sized businesses, generally under 250 employees. And the awards, there are other rules for this. These awards also, they cannot exceed 50% of the total cost of the planned project and would not exceed $25,000 during a calendar year. These businesses also must have an effective business plan, and they must have an economic need for these dollars that are being invested. This GAP funding is really a method to help with job retention, job creation, and job growth within our communities. Many of us around this table have small manufacturing and related companies in our districts that have benefited from this GAP financing. And this is really, truly a small investment for Minnesota manufacturers as an investment that will pay dividends in saved jobs and newly created jobs for years to come. So I do urge your support of this bill. And I am joined by Jim Girard, who will share more information about this project.
Mr. Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Girard. I'm a partner of Cook Girard Associates, and today I'm here on behalf of Enterprise Minnesota. Bob Kill, the president and CEO, who I think spoke to the committee earlier this year and went through a lot of the things that Enterprise Minnesota does, is in Washington, D.C., sharing the latest state of manufacturing survey with our congressional delegation. The one thing Bob always points out to people is that manufacturing is maybe a bigger part of Minnesota's economy than it's given credit for. And if you think about the number of businesses in your districts that actually manufacture stuff, that take ag products or that take mining products or that take forestry products and turn them into something that's exported throughout the United States and around the world, we really do have a very vibrant manufacturing economy here, and one that's gone through some pretty tough times along with a lot of other businesses. The survey this year, I think, is pretty interesting if you compare it to past years, because it frankly shows that manufacturing businesses are more enthusiastic and more hopeful for the future than they have been in a long time. They're looking to add jobs in the near future and expand their businesses as the economy picks up. So, like Senator Lilly says, I'm here today to ask for your support of Senate File 783, the Growth Acceleration Program. The bill, as Senator Lilly says, is a request for $1 million. The program has been funded starting in 2007 with $750,000, and in 2009, another $1 million. It's been a one-time appropriation each time. I think when you think about it, the companies use these funds to implement business improvement projects. And looking back to 2007, if you'll remember, the last part of 2007 is really when this crisis that we're in, this economic downturn that we've gone through, started. That's when I started to notice some of the businesses that I'd been working with were having difficulty getting new financing. And frankly, that's continued on to today. So I think when you look at this program in that light, during that time, we have had 145 manufacturing enterprises participate in the program. The return on investment has been $30 for every dollar invested, and some companies have seen a return of $40 for every dollar invested. Companies work with a consultant from Enterprise Minnesota. They pay for the upfront cost of the consulting program, and the money they then apply for and are reimbursed for part of that consulting payment. And so every company has to at least match one for one for the money that comes through the program, and it comes through DEED, which is the fiscal agent for the program. There was a survey done for 2011. It was a federal independent survey, and the 91 client companies in 1991, Enterprise Minnesota helped them retain sales of over 100 or get new sales of over $101 million, and they saved companies over $9 million in materials, energy, overhead, and other costs. The same audit found that Enterprise Minnesota helped those companies retain 750 jobs. That's a pretty good track record in a time when our economy has been going through some really, really tough times. So the continuation of funding is an important component of bolstering Enterprise Minnesota's ability to leverage federal dollars that come through the U.S. Department of Commerce's Manufacturing Extension Program called NIST-MEP. The cooperative agreement works solely to benefit small and medium-sized manufacturing companies, and the National Association of Manufacturers, whose outgoing CEO, John Engler, the former governor of Michigan, was on the cover of the last Enterprise Minnesota magazine, recently said that MEP is critical to the creation and retention of U.S. manufacturing jobs. Based on their latest report, which is from an independent survey, the MEP program created and retained 72,000 jobs in fiscal year 2009 and more than 318,000 jobs since the program was created in 1988. The one thing that Bob Kill would want me to reiterate, and he would reiterate if he were here, is that manufacturing is a key to our economic recovery and job creation. He always says, and I think many of you have had the opportunity to go through some of the businesses that Enterprise Minnesota has worked with, and I think they're in your packet. There is a list of businesses that Enterprise Minnesota has worked with over the years. But he will say time and again that manufacturing is a big part of Minnesota's economy, and it needs to be a part of the economic growth for the state in the future. So once again, I appreciate your time, and I appreciate your support. I know there are people looking around in the community, there are people that are actually in manufacturing in the state of Minnesota, and we appreciate the fact that they've gone through the hard times that we've seen in the last few years, and we're looking forward to working with the state of Minnesota and manufacturers in the future. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Further discussion on all 7, 8, 3? Okay, then we'll set this aside for possible conclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Lillian. Would you take this chair?
Yes, let's do a switch.
That's pretty quick, wasn't it?
As folks in the audience can tell, we have a lot going on today at the Capitol, and a lot of us are switching chairs and moving back and forth. Senator Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's about the fastest I've ever sat in a chair in my life. It's about 39 seconds, I believe.
You did great.
I couldn't screw up too bad with that. Senate file 790 deals with the Small Business Investment Tax Credits, also known as the Angel Tax Credit Program. You're all familiar with that. This was started on April 1st, 2010. The program provides investment credits to stimulate private investments in emerging businesses and encourages job creation. In 6 short months, the program has spurred $28 million of investment in 67 small companies. Senate File 790 is a housekeeping bill amending the tax credit program, providing clarifications needed to improve the program. None of them are controversial. Changes are lower minimum age for interns, increases the maximum previously raised equity from $2 million to $4 million, and changes some language as it deals with national person qualifications for the loan. So those are the changes. Hopefully you'll all agree with me that this has been a very successful program, and we wanted to keep forward, but these are just tweaking a few of the little problems we have. We have a couple witnesses here.
I'll go
please,
next.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Nelson. I coordinate the program for DEED, the Angel Credit Program, and I just wanted to explain what these three minor changes are. The first one is in regards to wage levels for interns. As many of you are aware, the bill provides that businesses can only participate in the program if they pay every employee, it's not an average, every employee at least 175% of the poverty level for a family of four. That's approximately $18.55. Within, I would say, the first couple days of administering the program, I had a number of businesses that were going saying, we have some interns here. Do they have to be paid $18.55 an hour? And I unfortunately had to say, according to the legislation, yes, they do. their response was, well, we're going to have to let those people go so that we can participate in the program. And so my immediate reaction was, well, let's try to fix that. The whole purpose here is job creation. Interns are just temporary employees. Let's see what we can do about that. We've met with representatives of the business community, of the investment community, and with members of the legislature, came up with a proposal that hopefully would meet everyone's needs, and that would be that interns would be required to be paid 175% of the federal minimum wage, which is more like $12 in some sense per hour. And that seems to be more in line with what interns get paid. That was issue number one. Issue number two is in regards to qualified investors and qualified funds. Last year, the program was amended at the last minute to provide that only natural persons can be allowed to get the tax credit, meaning that if you're an investor that qualifies under this program, you must be a natural person. That means if I pinch you hard enough, you bleed. You are not a corporation. You are not a partnership. You are a person. And the purpose for that was that we wanted angel investors to not just be putting money into companies, but as with most angel investing, that these people become participants in the company and that they serve as mentors to the companies. So therefore, we wanted people behind the money. We ran into a problem, however, that a number of investment funds made up of primarily people, some of these funds do have members that are non-natural persons. An example is in southeastern Minnesota. There is an angel fund that has one member. That's the Southeastern Initiative Fund. Because that initiative fund is not a natural person, the fund itself could not participate in the program. What we're seeking here is a small change that will allow an investment fund to have non-natural person members, even though that non-natural person member will still not qualify for the credit. So there's really no change in the program other than to allow some funds in that couldn't get in otherwise. The third change is a little more substantive. It is dealing with an inconsistency in the original bill. The original bill requires that businesses, in order to qualify for the program, have raised no more than $2 million in private equity financing. Further along in the bill is another provision that provides that no business may use the program to raise more than $4 million in equity financing. Last year, we had a number of companies that, reading through that information, got a little confused. They began participating in the program. They got certified in 2010 because they had not reached that $2 million level yet. They raised equity using the program, and then they came back in 2011 seeking to get recertified and finish getting equity financing up to the $4 million limit. But because we were in a new year and they had to get recertified and had now raised over $2 million, they weren't able to participate in the program. I won't go any further into detail there because I have asked Mr. Brian Anderson from Cachet Financial to speak to that point. He is one of our companies that sort of got caught in the timing trap. And Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Anderson.
Yes, Mr. Anderson, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brian Anderson. I am the CFO of a startup company named Cachet Financial Solutions in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. And again, following up to Mr. Nelson's comments is regarding where we got caught up a little bit in the minimum threshold from $2 million to $4 million. I'll give you a real-life example. On December 3rd, we became qualified as a small business corporation for this credit. Between December 3rd and December 31st, within those 3 to 4 weeks, I was able to get 13 accredited investors signed up, and we were able to raise $1.9 million under this program and provide those accredited investors those 25% credits. In January, we went to reapply thinking that I was going to use the full $4 million credit and was subsequently rejected because we had exceeded the $2 million minimum investment requirement, which I believe is just a little confusing and also not really maybe the intent of the original program. We were surprised as a company. This has been an incredible program for us to raise capital early on, and we're looking forward to use the other $2 million for our funding here in February. So this caught us by a little bit of surprise, and I don't think it was the intent that a corporation became qualified, you know, and then 3 weeks later they went to requalify, and just because of the timing that it passed over a year end, now we're being shut off from that other $2 million that we thought would be available to us. So again, the full $4 million would have been available to us if we had done it maybe at the first of the year or had timed that a little bit better. So right now we're looking for hopefully to get these changes in and be able to come back and hopefully, you know, recoup some of that $2 million and obtain some additional credit investors here, as we've got some additional funding here that's needed in the next 30 days.
Senator Metzen?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I kind of helped get this angel investment credit thing going a few years ago, and it's, as you can see, it's I believe it's a win-win situation. And like I say, in 6 short months, there was $28 million pumped into these funds and created 67 small business loans. So I think these are modifications that are good. I think the intern thing is good. I mean, it lets these younger people get involved a little bit and not probably make the 18 bucks, but make the 13, and it's a win-win thing there. And I think the $2 to $4 million is good, so I would encourage the committee to help me modify a couple of these changes and keep this program, very successful program, going.
Members, do we have any questions for Senator Metzen on this bill?
Thank you.
All right. So, Senator Metzen, my understanding is that we're going to keep the bill here versus sending it to the tax committee. Is that your understanding also?
That's my understanding so far, yeah. Yes.
All right.
So, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Nelson. I understand why? It does need to go to tax. They want to put it in
the omnibus. Okay, why? Because we're up in the two. Okay, I believe it. I'm told that it has to go to taxes, and they want to put it in. We think they'll put it in their omnibus bill, so maybe that's the referral. Dave, would you go?
Dave, did you have thoughts on this?
Mr. Chairman, members, it does have possible tax implications. I think it should go to the tax committee.
Right. I think they moved that threshold up from 2 to 4.
Doesn't. That's probably why. I don't know.
Just a moment.
Okay. Chairman, we usually don't refer to the other body, but apparently they sent it to the tax committee over there, and they. Feeling is to put it in a major tax bill, I guess. So.
Senator Metzen, I think what we would prefer to do would be to keep it here, and we could make a new decision at our next meeting to pass
sure.
it on to the. We'll follow up with you following the meeting. Are you,
Mr. Chairman? That's fine. It's got to get done. So that's
yes.
all I'm concerned about. So
absolutely, absolutely.
Thank you for your time.
All right,
Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You. So we've Senate File 790 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and we will have further conversations about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
I believe there's one person in the audience that wants to speak to the Angel Tax Credit Program in general.
Are they for it?
That's Mr. Schley.
Are you for it? You don't have to come up here if you are.
I wrote the book, so
all
I
right.
guess I'm for it. But it's some other cleanup matters. And one.
Sir, why don't you just take the microphone for 90 seconds? I apologize to not
That's
have
fine.
More time this morning, but I have a feeling we'll be talking about this again. Senator Metzen, I want to talk about this again next week. Look forward to that. Yes, sir.
I will be brief. Anticipating this might happen since it was last on the agenda, you should have a memorandum that I wrote laying some things out. My name is Michael Schley. I'm an attorney at the Larkin Hoffman Law Firm. I've been practicing in small business and corporate finance here in the Twin Cities for 30-plus years. I do not have a client that I'm representing today. These are my own comments. As I said, last year I was a big advocate of the bill, and the expansion to allow companies that were not venture capital-backed, so that they were smaller businesses, that had individual investors. I will take credit for I testified as that is that the committee initiated that and that was included. I also pointed out I did write the bill Deed has just published, the Deed has just published about this as well. The memo that I gave you has a number of items, most of which I think are housekeeping. The first is to calculate the dollar amount change slightly differently so that the happening of a year end in between does not diminish you. The example, I think, on the first page is very clear. I think the one item that I've run into with talking with clients that is probably not a housekeeping item is the minimum wage requirement. Do me a favor and look at the last page of the memo that I gave you. The problem that I see my clients and other people having is meeting that $18.55 minimum wage when they have employees for whom that wage level is unrealistic. If you're hiring somebody to come in and answer your phone, or you're hiring somebody to come in 2 days a week and do your books, or you're hiring a secretary part-time, you're going to be paying nowhere near that in the market. The sheet that's attached is I pulled up a job search agency yesterday, and I pulled up the state's own listings. These are people, these are positions that are open, and it's a listing of wage rates that are offered. What's going to happen and what is happening is, and the advice I've given clients is, you can't qualify. What you need to do is to terminate those people and hire an outside service, such as account temps, Robert Half, a secretarial service, in order to not disqualify yourself. I don't think that's the intention of what the bill was to do. It was to generate jobs. The jobs are still there at account temps and the like, but I don't think that's what was intended. I think most of the other things are housekeeping. I won't spend any time on them, but I'd ask you to seriously consider that as a policy change. And I think it's something that last year, if there'd been an understanding of that, it probably would have not been in the bill, or its application would have had some limitations.
And thank you, Mr. Schley. And I'd ask you to connect with the two gentlemen to your left, for sure, Senator Metzen and Mr. Nelson. Also, committee staff here who are ready to discuss and go through this. I know the memo is dated today, so I'm assuming this is fresh stuff, which is great.
Yeah, it's the ink is still burning.
All right. Well, I appreciate you sharing with this with us now, and I hope it can be put to good work. And members, we are on the floor as I speak. Committee adjourned.
Thank you.